Ladies and gentlemen, can I welcome you to the Polytechnic's 150th anniversary. Tonight's lecture is particularly significant as it celebrates the man without whom there is a high degree of probability we would not be gathered here together at 309 Regent Street. We're particularly honoured that Professor Eric Mottram will be lecturing to us this evening about Sir George Cayley. Our thanks to Eric Mottram are twofold. For lecturing to us this evening and also for his work on the writing of the script for our exhibition on Sir George Cayley, The Early History of Flight, Sir George Cayley to the Wright Brothers. I'd like to take the opportunity to thank those others who have assisted us and worked with us on the preparation for the exhibition and the Cayley events in the anniversary programme. Our thanks to our own academic and technician staff and to the many outside advisors who have so willingly given of their time and assistance. As well as Professor Mottram, I'd like particularly to thank Lieutenant Commander John Sproul, who worked with Jim Welch in our architecture workshops in making the replica of the riding rudder machine which you see in the exhibition. To Peter Jacob from the National Air and Space Museum at the Smithsonian Institution, Washington, for his assistance in the material on the 19th century flight and on the Wright brothers in the exhibition. And we're particularly pleased that Peter Jacob is able to be with us here this evening, and we look forward to his lectures later in the series on the achievement of the Wright brothers. Our thanks also to Sir Digby Cayley for the loan of certain items to the exhibition, which you will see in the display cases, particularly the daguerreotype portrait of Sir George Cayley and the set of instruments, drawing instruments, belonging to Sir George Cayley. To Jackie Anthony, the head of history at Sir John Cass School, for her work in preparing the school's guide to the exhibition. And our thanks also to Anglia Television, who have provided us with a copy of their film on Cayley, A Magnificent Man and His Flying Machine, which is on view in the foyer. And to the National Portrait Gallery, who have kindly reproduced the Cayley portrait in their collection as a National Gallery card for this occasion. Eric Mottram is no stranger to the Polytechnic. He has worked with us for a number of years in the field of cross-disciplinary work, often ignoring the restrictions of disciplinary boundaries and pioneering academic work in exploring the link between technology and cultural studies. He is Professor of English and American Literature at King's College and the University of London. He teaches a graduate course on technology and culture at the Institute of United States Studies. He has been visiting professor at the University of Pennsylvania and the Free University of Berlin. He is an active member of the American Studies Advisory Committee at this Polytechnic. His published works are numerous, and I'm glad to say that another one is soon to be added to the list, a series of essays on aspects of culture and technology entitled Blood on the Nash Ambassador, which is published by Hutchinson Radius, and you have an advance publicity notice of this on the seats here and also available on the table at the back. I think Chris Brookman and myself, over the past year, while we've been working on the exhibition and preparing the Cayley material, have sometimes felt that we have lived, breathed, and slept Sir George Cayley. But we both know that within the next hour we will realise how inadequate our knowledge has been. We will have to rethink our analyses and our theories. But above all, we know that our appreciation of Cayley's work will be greatly enhanced. Eric Mottram.
Thank you, Alan. And that is precisely what I'm going to do, is to try and supply as much information as I possibly can in an hour or so talking to you about this great man. And although I shall be dealing with his contributions to aeronavigation and the principles of flight, as well as the founding of this polytechnic, there's something else that I want to do, that is to place him within the early 19th century developments in politics and in technology in Britain, which he played an extraordinary part, and to say something about his other inventions, his other technological achievements besides aircraft. That is to rectify quite a number of neglects that have been going on over the years about this man. And the quotation that I used for my lecture title, A Man of the Most Universal Knowledge, is a statement by his grandson in appreciation of his knowledge of his grandfather. Sir George Cayley was undoubtedly one of the greatest experimental scientists and technologists produced in Europe. The Polytechnic Institution he founded in 1838 is one of his major inventions, demonstrating, as the Times newspaper stated on August 7th of that year, by the most simple and interesting methods, illustration, the sound and important principles upon which every science is based and the processes employed in the most useful arts and manufactures affected. That statement is very similar to a number of statements made by such pioneering figures and such philanthropic figures at this particular time. It has that exactly that ring. It could be duplicated elsewhere. But the Polytechnic pioneered adult education in technology as a cultural necessity for the developing industrial capitalist democracy. But Cayley's powers were, I think, like Benjamin Franklin's in the 18th century Philadelphia, in the traditions of the Royal Society, founded, as I'm sure you all know, in the later 17th century. Men who called themselves, and were called later, virtuosi, that is, men of abilities unrestricted by narrow specialization, in the terms of those centuries, the 17th, the 18th, and the beginning of the 19th, natural philosophers was the term. Cayley early exemplified the primary modern inventor-creator, the person, another great American scientist and writer on technology, but Mr. Fuller, called in 1949, the comprehensive designer. And in his 1959 essay, developing the concept of the engineer in the fullest sense, which I take Fuller to be concerned with here, and which I take Sir George Cayley to be a primary example of in the early 19th century, the man who is concerned with primary design as a scientist and as the creative man. In fact, the motto of the Royal Society, founded in 1663, was Nullius in Verba, which can be rather loosely, but I hope not too loosely, translated as nothing by mere authority. In Cayley's time, there were men determined to break the restriction of science and technology information to those in political and economic authority in decades dominated by the late 18th century American and French revolutions, and by the reformist movement in Britain, which led to the Reform Bill of 1832. Now, that is the historical context of this man. He was deeply involved in politics and became an MP for 2 to 3 years. I'll come to that later. We're talking about a man then who was a pioneer of practical aircraft flight and the necessary hot air engine for it, a member of parliament, a founder of this polytechnic, a founder and contributor to many local Yorkshire philosophical societies, engineering groups, things of that nature, the inventor of an artificial hand, of artillery designs, of the first practical caterpillar tractor, of the Drury Lane safety curtain, of a whole system of fire precautions to do with doors opening outwards rather than inwards at Covent Garden Theatre, which preceded the present-day Opera House, the inventor of a self-righting lifeboat, of a tension wheel, which he called it, but it was really a kind of bicycle wheel, that is, the wheel has a spring, so that the landing of aircraft wouldn't jar the occupant too much. An ink-carrying pen, he's beginning to sound a bit like Jefferson, and I think that's about the only person I know anywhere near this figure. I was thinking of Jefferson's marvelous multiple writing instrument, which you can see in Monticello, with about 8 pens on one stick. That must have been rather difficult. And various land reclamation schemes and methods. And in particular, he spent a lot of his time and energy on this, safety devices for railways, because between, in the 1830s and 1840s, the condition of free-for-all railway engine traffic was getting to be extremely disastrous. That's what one means when one says that he is part of the rise of the engineer, which is a main part of cultural history in the early part of this century. In 1909, Wilbur Wright, who pioneered engine and man-controlled flight with his brother Orville, wrote, "About 100 years ago, an Englishman, Sir George Cayley, carried the science of flying to a point which had never reached before and which had scarcely reached again during the last century." Cayley's flight achievements were certainly recognized in his lifetime and later in the 19th century. In 1843, for instance, these are quotations from a good deal of documentation. In 1843, Mechanics magazine, which is a very serious technological magazine in the 19th century, to which Cayley contributed some of his major articles. In 1843, the magazine said, "No man living has bestowed more attention on the subject of aerostation than the philosophical baronet, pursued it through so long a course of years and with so much zeal and perseverance, nor is there anyone who has brought more to the consideration of it more science or greater sagacity." Moving ahead to later on in the century, for instance, the French general L'Aéronaute declared in 1877 that Cayley was the father of aeronavigation. In 1923, Charles Dolfus, curator of the Musée de l'Air in Paris, stated it quite bluntly, "The aeroplane is a British invention. It was conceived in all its parts by George Cayley, the great English engineer who worked in the early part of the last century. The name Cayley is even in his own country little known, and even less people know the work of this remarkable man, the great genius of aviation." And as I'm sure you know, little has changed either in this country or in the United States, particularly to judge from the film that the BBC had the nerve to show on September the 12th about pioneers of aviation, which didn't even mention anybody before the Wright brothers, little and George Cayley. Nor, I may say, is his name mentioned in most of the histories of technology. I won't go into the details, but there are a large number of them with this omission, which is quite extraordinary to me. And one has to wait to quite later to the figures that who I'm drawing on for a lot of my information, not all of it, I may say. And we must pay tribute to these three people who did so much to promote Cayley's work when nobody else did. J.E. Hodgson's History of Aeronautics in Great Britain and his edition of the Notebooks of Sir George Cayley in 1933, and J. Lawrence Pritchard's essay on Cayley in the Journal of the Royal Society of Arts in 1958, and his very wonderful book called Sir George Cayley, the Inventor of the Aeroplane in 1961. Notice it took that long to write that book. And The Life of a Genius by Gerard Fairley and Elizabeth Cayley, which is a very curious book in many ways, and purports to, I quote, "to offer the character behind the genius, to suggest the driving forces working on the man himself, and," I'm quoting, "to tell the story of the private life of a genius." In fact, what happens is that a good deal of the dialogue in the book, I'm quoting the preface, is fictional, but not completely fictitious. I hope I'm not being rude when I say that this is not exactly a major source. During the disturbing state of depression following the Napoleonic War in the 1820s and 1830s, a number of efforts were made to educate the working classes into the nature of the relatively new industrial factory and agricultural system. There was a very famous society, which I'm going to have to cut down the large number of such bodies, Obviously, but if you can rely on me here, there were quite a large number. One of the most famous ones was called the Society for the Diffusion of Useful Knowledge. And you could see some of the opposition when I tell you that Thomas Love Peacock skeptically called it the Steam Intellect Society, being the steam engine was the model in those days. And there were many others of this kind. There was a great deal of circulation of journals among working men's institutes, among fairly liberal industrialists, particularly in the Midlands and in the North. And there were bills passed in the Commons to supply money for what was hoped to be the awakening of the public sense of importance to the new developments in the early 19th century in both the arts and the sciences. So there's a big context, and if one had time, one had to go into the details of this, but there is a large amount of activity of this kind, inside which Sir George Cayley's Polytechnic Institution, as it was called, is a primary factor. So I hope you don't think I'm writing it off by placing it among other things. That's not my intention at all. It's just to say that he is part of a very important development in the Reform Bill era. Part of that program, then, is that kind of need in education. And for Cayley, part of a certain philanthropic attitude towards British life. One of the most interesting things to me is a negative interest, that is, he did not belong to the major organization of non-London figures, inventors, technologists, artists of the time, the Lunar Society. But an investigation of the kind of people and their activities in the Lunar Society, which is founded for the precise reasons that I'm getting to here, that is the education of all sorts of people into a general cultural informative position. That kind of thing is exactly the developments that Cayley wanted to get into. These were, in fact, middle-class inventors and entrepreneurs who, although they believed in laissez-faire economics and not the destruction of the capitalist society, also supported the American and French bourgeois revolutions and the anti-slavery movement, which certainly Cayley also supported. This is the background for Cayley's youth and for his education, which I'm going to come to in a second. But there was something there already in London, when he came to London for part of his education, which he could pick up. No member of the Lunar Society, as far as I know, in my rather limited investigations, had anything to do, though, with Cayley's major occupation, that is, flight machines, aerial navigation, and the air combustion engine. Very curious that, with all their information, these very distinguished men didn't venture into that particular area. Cayley, of course, had an inherited estate, and had that amount of work to do, working on an agricultural estate, working with the organization of that. Therefore, he was without the necessity of patronage and without the necessity of getting the kind of education which you would generally have got from public schools at that time, that is, total absence of technology and politics. He had a very wise mother. His mother chose for his first tutor, George Walker, who was a fellow of the Royal Society, an excellent mechanic, as he would be called in those days, we say engineer these days, and a fine teacher of his private pupils in Nottingham, and a man of considerable political interest as well, as you might imagine from the kind of context I've been getting to. His second teacher was Cadogan Morgan, who's principal at Hackney College, London, author of a very important book at the time, Lectures in Electricity. And through him, Cayley gained considerable insight into reformist politics of the 20s, 30s period. Cadogan Morgan knew some of the important British figures. He'd also actually was present at the fall of the Bastille Kelly followed initially, pretty early in his life then, Morgan's sense of civil and religious liberty and republicanism, and met reformist Whigs of the day, such as Horne Tooke, who was a supporter of Thomas Paine and the Society of Constitutional Information, and Major Cartwright, who was another very important figure in constitutional reform at this time, in places such as the Crown Anchor Tavern in London, where there was that kind of conversation going on. At the age of 19, Cayley decided he wanted to renounce his title to the baronetcy when his father died, and a visit to France occurred, which made him change his mind about the revolution when he realized that it had yielded to tyranny. A very similar thing happened to many young men of his time, that interest in revolution and then its checking. But his sympathies with the principles of reform in Britain didn't change radically at all. There's a letter of this time which says, human society improves in all arts century by century, and the ultimate perfection of representative government cannot be thrust upon the state unfit to receive it. There's another addressed delightfully to my dear crazy mother. I am determined to be the slave of nothing but my reason, for it being the most exalted power of the human being. Once and for all, I swear never to play with the gentry of England. I am not tied to England. I am a citizen of the world, which has real overtones from Thomas Paine and other people at that time. I shall settle in that part I like best if Sir, in quotation marks, shall be changed to Citizen Cayley. In fact, he did not renounce his title, and he accepted nomination for the House of Commons and took his seat in 1832, a natural consequence within his career of his sense of the need for parliamentary reform. Acutely aware of the post-Napoleonic War conditions of the working classes in the 1830s, and in what was later called the Hungry 40s, when the cost of living rose and wages fell, and the poor law was made very severe indeed, and there were riots throughout Britain, and Chartist revolts in parts of it. Cayley's attitude towards this, as you might expect, was to curb revolution, but to act at Parliament towards all those Whig reform movements which went into the Reform Bill. May I just say that if you want a quick entry into the extraordinarily bad economic and social condition of this time, I would recommend you to read chapter 11 of Brooks Adams' The Law of Civilization and Decay, which deals with the state of the British economy at this time, which will explain to you very quickly why, in fact, Cayley and others were into the reformist movement. His entry into Parliament was prepared for by activities in York and in Yorkshire, in various political clubs, political reform clubs. He organized local branches of national clubs, all working towards suffrage and so forth at this particular time. So it was not surprising when he was, in fact, nominated for election and by his local people up there, because he'd become extremely active along those lines. But he withdrew his candidature in 1835, owing to the failure, as he saw it, of the Reform Bill, which he discovered was an act of highly limited democracy in an otherwise despotic parliament. And he has a phrase in a letter which he shows you he was still interested in something wider than the Reform Bill. He thought it had failed to produce, I quote his words, corporate reform. And therefore, he said to his constituencies in a letter he sent them saying, I'm not going to accept the candidature for Parliament again. The Reform Bill remained an incomplete guardian of your liberties. So he, in fact, retired from that scene. I think it's very obvious that his reasons were also that he wanted to spend much more time on aeronautics. In fact, there's a letter in which he says, personally, I am rejoiced to be relieved from the confinement of a parliamentary life. One does sympathize. During his visits to London, both before and after becoming an MP in 1832, Cayley met leading scientists and philosophers and began to formulate the idea of an institution where young people and still mentally young and alert adults could be educated into the developments of science and technology, which were rapidly accelerating into what we now recognize as the First Industrial Revolution. And as I said to you earlier, such things as mechanics institutes and meetings in a incipient trade union movement buildings became very common in this country. In 1821, for instance, Cayley had helped to found the Yorkshire Philosophical Society, quote, to promote science in the district by establishing a scientific library, scientific lectures, and providing scientific apparatus for original research. And this was not restricted to anybody could go to this particular place free. 10 years later, he founded the Scarborough Philosophical Society along the same lines. In 1830, he helped promote the Adelaide Gallery in the Strand in London, which was initially intended for pleasurable demonstrations and short lectures on science and technology. And when this declined, he instigated the idea, as it was first, of the Royal Gallery of Arts and Sciences in Regent Street. And in 1838, this became the Polytechnic Institution, and later, under a royal charter, it became the Royal Polytechnic. Let me, if you will, go into some of the details of this, because I think it's very significant how he went about this, and to show you the kind of extraordinary man he was. On December the 14th, 1832, he issued his first prospectus for the Polytechnic from 5 Cavendish Square, not far from here, for an, I quote, institution where the public, at little expense, may acquire by means of a laboratory, experiment rooms, and a gallery for the exhibition of novel inventions, a practical knowledge of the various arts and branches of science connected with manufactures, mining operations, and rural economy. It would combine, quoting again, it would combine in its results many of the advantages of the École Centrale des Arts et Manufactures in Paris. A second prospectus proposed an issue of 250 shares of £100 each to help finance the institution, and the stated aim of what Cayley called his poly, P-O-L-L-Y, immediately shows his clear sense of the modern necessity of this idea, which I think, if I may say so, still is of dire necessity in this country. The ignorance of technology and its part in culture in this country is completely chronic. This is what he says in his prospectus. The vast change which has of late years taken place in the nature of public recreation, from the trifling and non-substantial to the self-improving and solid enjoyments of cultivated minds, and the splendid advantage which scientific discoveries and mechanical inventions have secured to this country, both as regards her commerce and her domestic economy, have created a demand for intellectual gratification and a thirst for information in all matters related to science. And he adds very practically, and this is completely characteristic of Sir George, he adds, shareholders will be in the actual possession of security for their capital. He knew very well he wouldn't get people to put money unless they felt they were going to get something from it. Whether they did or not is another matter. The directors included MPs, men involved in mineralogy, engineering science. As chairman, Cayley had to find money, at the same time control those who supplied it, and there's some pretty bitter letters about this one. It's very familiar today, this problem, finding money from people who aren't fundamentally interested in education, to pay for education. Here's a letter of the time. We have laid out a good round sum of money, and the place, laboratory, its theatre, and its splendid gallery is well adapted for the display of scientific discoveries. And were it truly in scientific hands, so that scientific discoveries were thrown off here hot from the brain, and before they become public property for publication, sufficient novelty would be produced to excite public attention and to make it pay. We want a good scientific board confined to no aristocracy of orthodox men who sit like an incubus on all rising talent, which is not of their own shop. Freedom is the essence of improvement in science. But he managed to a certain extent, and the Polytechnic opening on August 6th was a stated fact, but accompanied by conditions very familiar to us in Britain today, especially at the moment when our Polytechnic is celebrating its 150th anniversary and trying at the same time to continue. In the first poly, visitors could experience the processes of printing, glassmaking, power weaving, lens making, and a rotary steam pump. And in the laboratory, students were taught the methods of experiment, attended lectures, and could use workshops and engines. The Great Hall contained two model canals with dockyard machinery, and at their junction, a tank for a diver to descend in a waterproof and airtight suit to demonstrate underwater work, and a diving bell, which proved to be one of the most profitable attractions at the institution. People just love going down in it. You have a look at it, if you see the drawings, and one wonders. Working models of many kinds were a further attraction, as well as a hydro-oxygen microscope with a 425-foot screen. Lewis Carroll allowed the first public production of Alice in Wonderland there in what were called, delightfully, dissolving views. Classes trained teachers in those principles of energy and chemistry so necessary for the Industrial Revolution. Naval officers and others studied engines and navigational changes, endemic to the radical transformations taking place as ships moved from sail to steam. Railway engine drivers were trained to skills required for this major form of transport. And this is one of Cayley's main areas of enterprise, into the appalling risks of the accidents going on the railways. Charles Green, the finest balloon pilot of his day, organized a series of experiments at the Poly, preparatory to his own proposed Atlantic crossing. Not surprisingly then, with such a vast array of exciting activities, the number of visitors and students increased rapidly throughout Cayley's lifetime. Queen Victoria and Prince Albert paid a visit, but it did fail to be a commercial success, in spite of its success in every other way. And in 1859, 2 years after Cayley's death, a new prospectus proposed a limited liability company to bring the Poly into monetary viability. At Cayley's death, the directors made a statement which partly said, "His earnest desire to diffuse and render popular a knowledge of science has been a great public good, and society loses a most valuable member." I think in many ways the Polytechnic drew together a lot of the moral issues in Cayley's life, that sense of the necessity for those in any kind of responsibility to enable people to understand their conditions towards possible reformatory change. In 1820, he wrote a statement of his beliefs in his wonderful notebooks. This is purely for his own describe his own intentions to himself, I suppose. "Inform myself of the useful branches of human learning, history, philosophy, political economy, political creed, practical acts, works of taste and genius. Apply knowledge in acting wisely and with energy in favor of one's country, one's family, oneself, and of the general welfare of the human race and others, the inferior creatures in man's care," presumably sort of dogs, lizards, and things of that nature. This program he maintained to the best of his considerable ability in the language of his day as a natural philosopher, as I said earlier. In 1796, Cayley records in his notebooks his first idea for mechanical flight, a variant of a device invented and flown by two Frenchmen in 1784, a helicopter model constructed from corks, wing feathers, and a bowstring. And he writes, "The next stage will be to control it by," I quote, "a man or first mover of adequate power. Speed is the great object of this invention, and this requires a different structure." Basically, what he describes in his notebook and what he draws is an aerial screw or propeller. 3 years later, he engraved a two-sided diagram on a silver disc of forces acting on a wing on one side, and on the other side, the sketch of the first of his aeronautical designs, an aeroplane both original and operable. It's signed GC, 1799, with a mysterious capital R underneath the initials, which, I hope I'm right in saying this, I'm sure I'd be corrected by some of you, that initial R remains conclusively uninterpreted. This is the most important pioneer design in aviation history. A pilot sits between the cambered wings of a biplane with tail planes and a fin behind him. The fixed planes thrust forward from manually operated paddles. Between 1799 and 1805, he built and tested full-scale fixed-wing gliders, having decided that an aircraft must have rigid wings, not the flapping ones of what was called an ornithopter. He also understood that lift and propulsion are two separate problems. There's a great deal of confusion up to this point in the construction of possible aircraft by fusing those two aspects of aeronautics. He was the first to realize that a cambered aerofoil on a wing provided more lift than a flat one. In his own words of 1806, the problem is to make a surface support a given weight by the application of power to the resistance of air. And his sense of space was equally clear and practical and innovatory. I quote one of his many statements about it. He called space an uninterrupted navigable ocean that comes to the threshold of every man's door. It ought not to be neglected as a source of human gratification and advantage. He was the first to understand bird propulsion through the propeller action of the outer primary wing feathers, the first to apply the dihedral angle, that is, two planes meeting at an angle, to aircraft wing and body for lateral stability, the first to suggest a tension wheel for undercarriage, as in later bicycle wheels, as a spring structure, the first to investigate the movement of the center of pressure on an aerofoil, to investigate aeronautical streamlining. He studied trout and woodcock and other streamlined animals quite considerably. That is, towards a solid-based design for least resistance, and to suggest an internal combustion engine for aircraft. That is, he applied scientific methodology to flight technology and worked out the basic configurations for a practical airplane by separating the problems of lift, propulsion, and control systems. And this was quite beyond the regressive designs, some of which are still in his notebooks. One mustn't think of somebody who just is struck by the inspiration. There's a hard-working, rethinking, and innovative thinking going on simultaneously, and he's still reluctant to give up old-fashioned ideas. And that's the the fascination, I think, of watching this man work inside the available text that we've got. In 1802, he worked on wings to sustain a craft and a man with a two-horsepower engine, and in his writings, placed himself extremely carefully within the history of flight. He knew exactly where he was, from Daedalus, the Greek inventor, through to Bishop Wilkins in the 17th century. That is, from what a famous Irish writer called the fabulous artificer, Daedalus of ancient Greece, who escaped by air from Crete and landed 750 miles away near Naples, right through to Bishop Wilkins, who was Oliver Cromwell's brother-in-law, who in 1648 published a book called Mathematical Magic, or The Wonders That May Be Performed by Mechanical Geometry. This man clearly fascinated Cayley. Wilkins was a turning point between religious superstition against human flight, but he was a founder of one of the founding members of the Royal Society, and a major classifier of flight methods other than those of birds, angels, and witches, and wrote with an accuracy about flight which must have appealed to Cayley. He wrote about a potential aircraft, for instance, that it can never be too big or too heavy. If the space which it possesses in air and the motive faculty in the instrument be answerable to its weight. I think if someone said to me, who was the pioneer of aircraft who wrote that, I would have said Cayley straight away, but it's not, it's Bishop Wilkins. Wilkins also stated, and this fascinated Cayley, that there was a man in England who was already capable of taking gliders up to 300 feet. Certainly, Cayley believed it could be achieved. And in a letter on what he called aerial navigation, he writes, there can be no doubt of the thing being accomplished. I could make several engines, that is, flying machines, that would mount with a person to work them into the air, but the invention would be of no use till the conveyance from place to place a great distance from each other can be accomplished with ease. And you can see how early this letter is, either by muscular strength or by the power of some moving engine. So he was always not only concerned with wings, streamlining, tail fins, and so forth, but with the invention of a hot air engine, which would be less bulky than the steam engine, most of which were very big, which was the only modern engine available in his early lifetime, and certainly less dangerous than the gunpowder engine, if you can imagine going up an airplane where the engine was run by gunpowder. His tension wheel was designed to reduce splintering and shock to the rim. His tubular beam construction reduced aircraft frame weight. And as I said, the streamlining was part of his experiments and thinking about air resistance on object. When he built a full-size man-carrying glider, he described it very carefully so that we can compare it with a similar flight at the beginning of the 20th century by Wilbur Wright. I quote from Cayley, "When any person ran forward with it, with his full speed, taking advantage of a gentle breeze in front, it would bear upward so strongly as scarcely to allow him to touch the ground, and would frequently lift him up and convey him several yards together." There's a beautiful video in the exhibition in the foyer of the Poly, which shows you a later aircraft doing precisely that. What he's talking about is hang gliding, 90 years before the German Lilienthal and the American Chanute and the Wrights, part of what Cayley called the efficient mechanics of the engineering age. On his Brompton estate in Yorkshire in 1849, Cayley sent a boy up a few feet in a full-size plane, 10 feet wingspan, 20 feet long, which he described as his boy carrier. I quote, "A boy of about 10 years of age was floated off the ground for several yards on descending the hill, and also for about the same space by some persons pulling the apparatus against a very light breeze by a rope." In 1853, in his new flyer, it was called, the Wright brothers called their planes flyer repeatedly as well, Cayley's coachman flew across a valley on the estate for about 500 yards. The landing overturned the underslung car, and the coachman reportedly, quote, reportedly, shouted back across the valley after his historic flight, "Please, Sir George, I wish to give notice I was hired to drive and not to fly." It is amusing, but just think of the poor man being raised into the air, goodness knows how many feet, and then crashed into a valley. I mean, I don't think I would like it now. In 1837, Cayley produced a paper for Mechanics magazine on aerial navigation, 20 years after his pioneering philosophical magazine essay called On Aerial Navigation in 1816. He proposes, and I'm quoting, that lighter first movers than steam engines may be discovered and made applicable to propelling balloons in order to render these, quote, serviceable to mankind. And then he goes into the practicality of the cost of hydrogen, the security of airtightness, the possibility of using thin metallic sheets. I may say that the first metal airship flew nearly 100 years later, so he was pioneering this idea. And repeatedly stressing the need to coordinate all known information on pressures, speeds, engine power, and construction. That's one of the reasons why he tried to get going some kind of British aeronautical society to coordinate information so that it would be available for everybody rather than a series of discrete pioneers. But he didn't succeed in his lifetime, which is a pity, and the French, in fact, were the first to develop an aeronautic society in the 19th century. All part of, I may say, an enormous amount of activity going on by the 1840s and 50s in Europe to do with aircraft. And finally, I want to move on to, as I promised you, activity to do with the railways, which is a very important matter at this particular time. The sheer number of accidents that were taking place on the railway systems, well, the Harvey systems, lines, was extraordinary. There were a series of bills passed in Parliament. Largely anybody, really, could set an engine on a railway line. There was no up and down lines. There was no signalling system. It was extremely difficult for trains to stop. Cayley came up with an extraordinary idea of how to get passengers onto trains without stopping them, which I'll come to in a second. In 1826, he sent to the Mechanics magazine a design for, I quote, a patent universal railway, by which he meant an elementary caterpillar traction, and wrote that he and his friend, and it turns out to be G.W. Morgan, his tutor, had worked on that. He did think about that idea as being a basic railway engine structure, but he soon gave it up and had terrible problems with patents. Here, if one had time, we'll have to go into the problems that he had about getting things patented so his ideas would not be stolen and used for all sorts of private needs. And on the other hand, his sense that he, like Benjamin Franklin, he felt that his inventions should be made available to the public in general rather than for profit. That there was a tussle in his mind about this quite conclusively. In 1831, he made a communication to the Mechanics magazine concerning an accident at the opening of the Manchester-Liverpool Railway the previous year, in 30. Stevenson's rocket ran over the legs of William Huskisson, the reformist politician, during a passenger panic. Cayley writes a piece called Practical Hints on Railway Travelling, and he mixes both the practical, the idea of possibilities of bumpers, and possibilities of having a series of what he calls passenger collecting points, and also one highly impractical idea, I think, of a large net rope bag to scoop up from the platform into the train those he calls men of activity into a moving carriage. He adds with dry humour, I quote, "I merely state the principle. In practice..." In practice, it may be difficult to render the plan sufficiently safe. Lovely idea. Try again. Not surprisingly, in 1841, he published a collection of railway papers, and they seriously tackle increasing railway accidents. He drew attention to the necessity of speed controls for compressed air springs in special carriages at each end of the train to supplement buffers. And this will give you an insight into what it was like for padded cushions in all classes of carriage. I quote, "For each man's life is equally valuable to himself and should be equally protected. Passengers never to be seated exactly opposite each other." And here's something you're familiar with in cars and airplanes these days. I quote, "A broad padded belt to retain each passenger in his place in case of accident, and prevent a collision with each other," but that's sitting opposite in the train. And he added, "How John Bull may relish this sort of straight waistcoat, I do not know." But of course, such safety issues remain highly controversial in transport to this day, as you know. He also made lots of suggestions about automatic wheel brakes for collision accidents and methods of controlling distances between carriages and so forth. Also, he advocated government legislature, I quote, "to ensure safety of life and limb, not to simply leave it to such measures of care as directors or agents of railroads may choose when engaging, danger or no, a complete monopoly of the public means of conveyance." This is an early grasp of the privatization for profit as a highly dangerous activity. And Cayley's pamphlet of this time constituted part of a major protest and discussion in the 1840s that led to the Railway Act of 1844. Some MPs favoured the abolition of the railways. The Duke of Wellington, not a particularly well-known liberal, reluctantly consented to open the Manchester-Liverpool line, very reluctantly because he believed, I quote, "the railway would dangerously encourage the lower classes to move about. And also trains were thought to, and maybe they do, were believed to spread epidemic diseases and choke people, I quote, with the fumes of phenol and carbolic, while tunnels caused dreadful forebodings in people. So there was a great deal of lively activity about rows at this particular time. I think one of the most important suggestions he made was what is now called the block system of signalling, that is, warning signals, so that up trains will always keep to one set of rails, I'm quoting, and down trains to another. We take this for granted, but in those days it certainly was not. His idea was that signal posts too should be a mile apart and to be set at danger automatically and cleared when the train passed safely to the next section. As usual, Cayley's aim was public benefit in this case, what he called this noble, most useful and delightful invention, which gives to man so much wider scope of action and must therefore proportionately accelerate his civilization improvement, and it will obtain most serious attention and cautious support of an enlightened legislature. Those are the kind of words he usually uses when he's writing up these things for publication, in particularly in the Mechanics magazine, which he used so often. Safety measures, he said, were to prevent the death's head and crossbones becoming the appropriate crest for railway carriages belonging to the directors of the new railway companies. It does sound familiar. I haven't got time to go into all the details of the Railway Act at this particular time, but the context of this is a very serious matter, that between 1834 and 1845, the number of increases in private railway acts was enormous. There were 14 in 1834, there were 42 in 1837, and then what was called the railway mania started. 48 private acts were legislated in 1844 and 120 in 1845. But there was no control over these things at all. And they were heavily backed by capital investment. So again, one needs a context for understanding what Cayley was into in his particular life here. Well, I hope that so far I've suggested to you some of his most extraordinary ideas and his scope and range. There's very much more to talk about in connection with his life. But I hope I've said enough to suggest to you what his grandson meant when he said, and it seems to be nearly an understatement, that he was a man with the most universal knowledge. And it certainly has given me extreme pleasure to suggest some of the range and care this very great man, who was born in 1773 and died in 1857, but who we're celebrating right now, and very accurately, if I may say so. Thank you very much for your attention.
Something which we will hope you will keep on your mantelpiece and will be further advertisement and PR for the Polytechnic.
Thank you very much, sir. It's very kind. Thanks a lot. Great. I suppose I better demonstrate what it is. Oh, Lord. Isn't that nice? Yeah. I never touched the stuff, actually.
Peter. Thank you very much. It's got the Polytechnic crest on it there. Isn't that nice? Thank you. Great. Well, I guess we're all going to have a...
Yes, bring it with you.
Yes, everybody wants to see it.